I mentioned last week that in July, we're going to start a new study on prayer. And in the intervening weeks, I was going to look at a couple of Psalms with you. And so tonight, I'd like to look at Psalm 5 with you. And there's the scripture, as well as just a brief outline structure of the Psalm on the back of your prayer sheet tonight. And Psalm number 5. Last week, we looked at Psalm 4, which some people entitle an evening psalm because it makes reference to the psalmist being comforted and feeling in security because he can lie down and sleep at night, knowing that the Lord's presence and strength is with him. In Psalm 5, we have reference to the morning. And so sometimes Psalm 5, the psalm right next to it, is called a morning psalm. And so Psalm 4 is an evening psalm. Psalm 5 is a morning psalm. And both of them are attributed to David. Again, in Psalm 4, David is referencing people who are slandering him, who are saying all kinds of hurtful, evil things about him, and he's crying out to the Lord for help, for his mercies to come and to rescue him. Psalm 4 is more a psalm of deliverance, whereas in Psalm 5, David is clearly battling with some enemies who are opposed to him. We don't know exactly who those enemies are because they're not specifically named, either in the psalm itself or in the superscription or the title at the top of the psalm. So we don't know exactly who these enemies are, but David knew who they were, didn't he? He knew who those people were. He knew the threats that they were presenting to him. And Psalm 5 has a little bit more emphasis on the justice and the righteousness of God, that God would not only come to the aid of David, but that in doing so, he would also establish his justice and his righteousness in punishing evildoers and in making God's holy righteousness known in the way that he dealt with those who were wicked and in opposition to God's king, David. And so Psalm 5 is a mourning prayer. It's a lament asking God or crying out to God for help because of the difficulties that he's experiencing at the hands of his enemies. But it's also a prayer for God to deal with those enemies and to deal with them in a righteous way, and to come to the aid of David's cause. I put this kind of a structure for the psalm at the bottom there, and this comes from Willem van Gemeren's commentary. And the way he's structured the psalm or broken down the structure, you can see kind of a chiastic structure where you have certain elements that are repeated, but with a little bit different emphasis. And so, for example, in the first part of the psalm, verses 1 through 3, you have David crying out to God. It's a prayer for justice. Whereas the complement to that is in verse 8, where David once again is expressing his prayer to God, this time specifically referencing God's righteousness. And so those two kind of go together as pairs. Same thing with the B pairs. You have an affirmation of God's hatred of evil. In verses 4 through 6, he talks about his enemies. He talks about their character, their evil ways, some of the things that they were doing. And he very clearly lays out that God is in opposition to those who are evil. And then that is matched in verse 9 with another affirmation of God's hatred for evil. And then in verse 7, and then again in verses 10 through 12, we see David express his hope. In verse 7, his hope is in fellowship with God, in the presence of God. And in verses 10 through 12, his hope is in God's character, his righteousness, that God will establish his justice. And so we'll kind of use that as our kind of guideline or outline as we walk through the psalm. But let's read through the psalm, and then we'll walk through it together. Psalm 5, David says, "Listen to my words, Lord. Consider my lament. Hear my cry for help, my King and my God, for to you I pray. In the morning, Lord, you hear my voice. In the morning, I lay my requests before you and wait expectantly. For you are not a God who is pleased with wickedness. With you, evil people are not welcome. The arrogant cannot stand in your presence. You hate all who do wrong. You destroy those who tell lies. The bloodthirsty and deceitful you, Lord, detest. But I, by your great love, can come into your house. In reverence, I bow down toward your holy temple. Lead me, Lord, in your righteousness because of my enemies. Make your way straight before me. Not a word from their mouth can be trusted. Their heart is filled with malice. Their throat is an open grave. With their tongues, they tell lies. Declare them guilty, O God. Let their intrigues be their downfall. Banish them for their many sins, for they have rebelled against you. But let all who take refuge in you be glad. Let them ever sing for joy. Spread your protection over them, that those who love your name may rejoice in you. Surely, Lord, you bless the righteous. You surround them with your favor as with a shield. And so David begins the psalm with a prayer in verses 1 through 3 for God's justice. He says, "Listen to my words, Lord, and consider my lament." When we think of lament, it is a time of difficulty, isn't it? It's a time of sorrow, a time of mourning, when things are not going well. Psalm 5 is a reminder that at times in our lives that life is going to get bumpy. And life is not always smooth for a child of God, in opposition to whatever Joel Osteen might say, right? Sometimes as a child of God, life is not always easy. Sometimes it's difficult. And here for David, he is experiencing a time of difficulty, a time of opposition, enemies who are hating him, enemies who are lying about him and directly opposing what he is trying to do as God's king. And so he's crying out to God. And the thing with lament is it comes about in times of sorrow and in times of difficulty. But lament is not just an inner reflection or an inner wallowing in that sorrow. Lament is a pouring out of it to someone else, specifically to God. And so it's not just something that he's thinking or feeling, but something that he's expressing. And he's expressing it to God. So, Lord, hear my words, he says, and consider my lament. He says, hear my cry for help. So David is not just mourning over his circumstances, though he is doing that, but he's also asking God to intervene, right? He's asking God to help him, to intervene in the situation. And so he cries to God for help. And notice how he refers to God. My king and my God. Who was David? David was the king, wasn't he? But yet he refers to God as my king. So it kind of brings to our minds the title of God, the King of Kings, right? The Lord of Lords. So here is David. He is a king, but he's not the ultimate king, is he? There is a king who is higher. And so David, even as powerful as he was and all the influence that he had in Israel, he recognized his place of humility, that there is my God and my king who is above me, to whom I owe loyalty. But in addition to owing loyalty and submission and obedience to God, there's also a personal element to it, isn't there? Because he doesn't just say the king, the God, but he references him in a very personal way, doesn't he? You are my king. You are my God. And so he claims a link of relationship between him and the creator of heaven and earth. And so God is not just some abstraction out there. He is a personal God with whom David has a relationship through covenant. And so he cries out to him for help. And he says in verse 3, in the morning, Lord, you hear my voice. In the morning, I lay my requests before you and wait expectantly. Many of the commentaries that I read specifically tied the morning prayer that David is making here with the morning sacrifice that would often be made at that particular time in Israel's history. And so the priests would offer a sacrifice every morning. And accompanying that sacrifice would be prayers that would be made. So the times would be similar. In fact, some alternate translation of in the middle of verse 3 In the morning, I lay my requests before you. A possible rendering of that word requests is sacrifices. So I lay my sacrifices before you as I pray. And however we take that, whether David is talking about his requests, his burdens that he's laying before God, or if he's talking about a literal animal sacrifice, either way, the picture of the language is that of sacrifice. He's laying it down before God. And the word for lay there is the idea of arranging. Same word that is used in conjunction with sacrifice with the arranging of the wood or the arranging of the animal that would be on the altar. And so even if he's talking about his requests, it's still in the language of sacrifice. Lord, I'm presenting this to you. I'm laying this out before you. And then he says, God, I'm going to wait, but I'm going to wait expectantly, trusting and hoping that you will answer my prayer. And so verses 1-3 is a prayer for God to help, for God to intervene. And then in verses 4-6, David begins to kind of express some things about his God, some elements of God and his character, specifically with the way that God views sin and sinners. And so in verses 4-6, he's not necessarily addressing a prayer request per se, but he's praying to God about God's character and in a way that all of the community of Israel can hear and listen to. Because remember, these Psalms, even though they may have originated as individual laments or an individual prayer, they quickly became integrated into the corporate worship of Israel, didn't they? And so the whole people of Israel might have used this psalm in conjunction with a morning sacrifice as a part of their community worship of God. And so this is an expression of how God feels about evil. And he says in verse 4, "For you are not a God who is pleased with wickedness. With you, evil people are not welcome. The arrogant cannot stand in your presence. You hate all who do wrong. You destroy those who tell lies. The bloodthirsty and the deceitful you, Lord, detest." It's pretty strong language, isn't it? You see several times there just the very strong way in which David is expressing it. God, you're not pleased with wickedness. Evil people are not welcome. But then it gets even stronger, doesn't it? So, Lord, you're not pleased with this. They're not welcome. That's a little bit more passive. But then it's going to get more active and direct. The arrogant cannot stand in your presence. You hate all who do wrong. That's pretty strong, isn't it? Let me ask you a question. Have you ever heard the expression, God hates the sin, not the sinner? What do we do with verse 5? What does it say? It doesn't say you hate the wrong. It says you hate those who do wrong. And so it's not just that God is angry with sin. He certainly is. But there's an element of God's righteous indignation and wrath that is directed against the sinner, him or herself, isn't it? And so the person who is wicked before God, they stand in a very precarious situation, don't they? Because they're under the wrath and the condemnation, might we even say the hatred of God. And so it's a very serious situation. He says, you hate all those who do wrong. You destroy those who tell lies. God's character is such that he is holy and he cannot stand to be in the presence of sin. And therefore, he must deal with sin and deal with sinners. And so they're not welcome in his presence, but he also actively judges them. He destroys them who tell lies. The bloodthirsty and the deceitful, you, Lord, detest. Again, another synonym of the idea of hatred or abhorrence. Let me ask you, in verse number 6, isn't it interesting how closely aligned are the idea of violence and deception. The bloodthirsty and the deceitful. And joined together by a simple and, it says, Lord, you detest them. How often in our thinking do we make these compartments and say, murder is really bad, but telling a lie, that's not so bad. And yet here you have bloodthirstiness, violence, bloodshed, murder, and deception joined together and saying, Lord, you hate those who do these things. All sin is serious, isn't it? All sin is serious before a holy and a righteous God. And so in verses 4-6, David, it's almost as if God is, David in verse 2 is saying, Lord, help. And then in verses 4-6, David is expressing the character of God for which God would help. So David is saying, God, help. And here's why, because this is who you are. You hate evil and those who tell lies and those who are violent. So God, intervene on the basis of who you are. That's what he's praying. And then he makes a very strong contrast in verse 7 of hope to be in fellowship with God. Verse 7, he says, but I, by your great love, can come into your house. In reverence, I bow down toward your holy temple. So, very big contrast, isn't it, between those who do evil are not welcome. Those who tell lies, those who are violent, they cannot stand in your presence. But I, Lord, can come into your house, and in reverence I bow down toward your holy temple. Just a reference to the presence of God. And bowing down toward is the idea of facing, wherever you are, facing toward the holy presence of God. The glorious presence of God, which was associated with the Ark of the Covenant in the Holy of Holies, in the tabernacle, and then later in the temple. God, I bow down toward your presence, and I want to be in your presence, in your house. Psalm 23, he says, surely I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. And so he wants to be in God's house, and he has confidence that he will be in God's house. But now I want to ask this question. How is it that David can make this hope in contrast to the wicked? Is it based on David's righteousness versus their unrighteousness? It's by grace, isn't it? Even he says that. How is it that David can have the hope of coming into his house? He doesn't say, because of my righteousness, I can come into your house. He says, by your great love, I can come into your house. And the word love here is that Hebrew word. It's almost hard to translate with one English word. Chesed, faithful, loyal, covenantal love, faithfulness, mercy, all wrapped up in one word. It's associated with everything good, everything loyal, everything faithful, everything gracious that comes to the people of God through his covenant with them. And David says, by that, I can come into your house. And I, in reverence, not in quaking, shivering fear, but in a fear of awe, in a fear of reverence, I can come and prostrate myself in humility before you, Lord. So, very clear distinction between the evil and those who are welcomed into God's presence by his grace. And then he prays again with a request in verse 8. This is a prayer for God's righteousness. Lead me, Lord, in your righteousness because of my enemies. Make your way straight before me. So in verse 7, David affirms God's grace, doesn't he? I can come into your house because of your great love. But then in verse 8, it's a prayer for God to help him walk in his life in a way that accords with God's righteous character. So God, help me to live, to walk in a way that follows your righteousness. Lead me in your righteousness because of my enemies. Why would he say that? Well, they're probably looking for any possible opportunity to accuse him. any possible opportunity to trip him up, almost kind of like Daniel's enemies in the book of Daniel, where they were looking for anything that they could pin on Daniel to get him in trouble. And they couldn't find anything. It's almost as if that's what David is praying here. Lord, help me to walk the straight and narrow path because of my enemies looking on me, wanting to find something in me that they can use against me. Make your way straight before me. The idea there is to take a hilly, rocky, rough place and to smooth it out and make it straight. In other words, make his way successful. So God, lead me in your righteousness, keep me on the straight path, and make that path bounteous, plentiful, or prosperous before you. Prayer for God's righteousness in his own life. And then in verses 9 and 10, he returns back to the evil again and those who do evil. He says, not a word from their mouth can be trusted. Again, the idea of deception. Their heart is filled with malice. The idea of malice is just ill will, hatred toward other people, isn't it? Wishing bad or evil to come on someone else. It's in their heart. Their throat is an open grave. With their tongues, they tell lies. Interesting, isn't it, how much emphasis is on the sins of the tongue? They lie. Their mouth cannot be trusted. Their throat is an open grave. With their tongues, they tell lies. Does verse 9 sound familiar to you? Especially the last part of verse number 9? We read it just a couple of Sundays ago in Romans 3. Paul quotes from Psalm 5 in Romans 3 in his long list of Old Testament quotations, where he's piecing together all these quotations from the Old Testament to show the universality of sin in the human race. And here is one example of that, the deception and the ill will that lies in the heart and expressed through the words of sinful human beings. And here David is ascribing that to his enemies. They're deceptive. They hate me. They look on me with malice. They can't be trusted. And then verse 10, sometimes when we come across a verse like verse 10, it's almost shocking to our ears. Because it brings in the idea of God's judgment, that God's judgment would fall on his enemies. And he says in verse 10, declare them guilty, O God. Let their intrigues be their downfall. Banish them for their many sins, for they have rebelled against you. Now, the last part of verse number 10 is really important. Because what David is doing here is he is not asking for personal revenge. He's not praying to God for God to get them for David's sake. He's praying for God to righteously and justly execute his justice for God's sake. Is David the victim of their cruelty and their maliciousness? Absolutely. But there's a greater victim, if you will, isn't there? And that is God, one who has been sinned against. And he says in verse 10, banish them for their many sins, their wrongs, for they have rebelled against you. Verse 10 fits into this category in the Psalms that sometimes we refer to as the imprecatory Psalms, in which the psalmist, such as David, will wish something bad to come on his enemies. And we read that today and we think, can we pray a prayer like that? Is this a kind of a model prayer that we as Christians can pray that God would punish our enemies? And I think one thing that we need to keep in mind is that this, for one thing, this is a prayer that's being prayed in the context of the Old Covenant. And specifically in the Old Covenant, was God's promises to the descendants of Abraham that I will bless those who bless you and I will curse those who curse you. And so when David is praying for God's curses, if you will, to fall, it's because they've already expressed their ill will towards God's people. But also, importantly, when we see these prayers, we need to remember that these are not prayers that arise out of personal vindictiveness or personal vengeance. These are prayers, though they are harsh and sometimes come across very harsh, these are prayers that appeal to the righteousness of God. for God to express his holiness and righteousness in fairly judging those who do wrong. Well, what about us today? Should we pray for God to judge our enemies? Well, I think yes and no. I think no in the sense that we should have a heart of grace and compassion toward all people as expressed in the gospel, that we should be willing to share the gospel, the good news with anybody, even as Jesus says, even those who mistreat you, those who treat you badly, your enemies, to even love them. But I think there it's not wrong to pray for God to work out his justice and to do what is right. And I think if we were to pray something like this, I would say, first, let's pray for the conversion of their souls and that God would be merciful to them and that he would draw them to grace and forgive them. But at the same time, we know that not every person in the world is going to come to Christ and be forgiven. There are many who on the last day are going to be judged. But it's in that spirit that we can pray for God's justice to come. Maybe not necessarily in the here and now, but that one day, God, you will establish your justice. And in the sense of what Paul says in Romans 12, leave vengeance to God. I will repay, saith the Lord. And so, yes, God, be just and righteous in the judgment of your enemies, but do that in your time, in your way. In the meantime, help me to live righteously and graciously before people in the world and to show the love of Christ to them. But the main idea here is David linking their wicked actions, not necessarily to him and how they wronged him, but how they wronged God. And David praying that God would punish them for their sins. And then he finishes with an affirmation, again, of his hope in God's righteousness. And here he moves beyond the personal to include all of God's people. He says, let all who take refuge in you be glad. Let them ever sing for joy. Spread your protection over them, that those who love your name may rejoice in you. The idea of spreading God's protection over them probably brings in the image of a mother bird who brings her wing over her young and shields them and protects them from harm. That's the idea that's presented there. In other words, those who trust in God, those who fear God, those who believe in him, those who lean on him, God is a source of protection, comfort for them. And that comfort, that protection, that shield that God presents around them is a source of joy and worship and comfort in their hearts. And so he finishes by saying, surely, Lord, you bless the righteous and you surround them with your favor as with a shield. So we may not have a physical shield around us, but we have God's grace around us. God's grace and favor for those who seek him. And that is our inheritance. That is our blessing. It is not necessarily that we have all of the good things in life, but that we have God. We have his favor, his grace upon us. Again, I think, you know, no matter what we have going on in our lives, and we may not be facing something as specific as David was facing, we may not be able to put a specific face on an enemy like David could, but we have all kinds of challenges and circumstances that are arrayed against us, don't we? And in this, we can pray for God to shield and protect his people, for God to be just and righteous and to do what is right for his people, and to be just with regard to those who are against God and against his people. And in the end, our hope needs to be not in our strength, not in the resources that we have available to us in this world, but our confidence, security needs to be in God. He is our everlasting shield and portion.